Welcome to the Accessibility Solutions Podcast, hosted by Linda Hunt, an award-winning accessibility consultant, speaker, and author. With over 30 years' experience in senior management roles and a deep passion for creating inclusive environments, Linda brings us unmatched expertise and credibility to our discussions. Join us as we explore the transformative power of accessibility and inclusion in today's world. Through captivating conversations, Linda shares her wealth of knowledge, provides practical solutions, and sheds light on the latest trends and advancements in the field. Whether you're a business owner or a disability advocate or simply curious about the world of accessibility, this podcast is your go-to resource. Get ready to unlock new perspectives, break down barriers, and embark on a journey of empowerment. Are you ready to create a more inclusive world? Let's begin. Welcome to the Accessibility Solutions Podcast.
Pleased to have Erin Edgar back with us again for this episode. Erin is an attorney and an entrepreneur who happens to be blind. Started her own law firm in 2020, focusing on providing wills, trusts, and other end-of-life documents, primarily to parents of disabled adult children who will be unemployable at the present time due to their disability. Not working, she enjoys creative pursuits such as bird watching, music creation, and performance. She also prides herself on being a transformation junkie. Erin lives in North Carolina with her husband. So welcome back, Erin. I know we had a discussion episodes ago around your experience with barrier. What I want to talk about today is really the work that you around providing wills, trusts, and life doc for parents of. So I'm gonna like it's very it's only a topic that I think with parents of that has a disability. You know, in Canada when that child turns 18 and kind of is out of all of this as a child with a disability, then for a lot of them, this kind of known state that now they're really, and yet the parent is still a primary caregiver responsible for them. I'll let you take it away in terms of you that you do, which is so very, very important and not something that I think a lot of people are or talk about very often.
First of all, Linda, thank you for having me back. I know we had a wonderful discussion last time, being on for a two-part that I appreciate very much. And I am happy to come back and talk about the work that I do and how it benefits the disability community. First of all, I would like to make a disclaimer that this is not legal advice and definitely should not be interpreted as the law of state or province. I don't know anything about Canadian law, and I don't know a whole lot about law that exists outside my own state in the U.S. I'm not authorized, so to speak, to talk about that, and I cannot give specific advice. But I do want to highlight something you said, Linda, and speak in terms about the problem that faces many disabled, having been disabled children. They come into, or you know, a social state of adult, and a lot of the supports for them, and they're not helped the same way that they were. That happens in Canada too, and in the United States, I know in Canada it's different. I think we talked about, but in the United States, it's mostly a federal purposes of determining disability and work requirements. Many states have adopted the federal rules in mind, and so standards are similar. But basically what happens is you're in primary and secondary school as a child, and in the United States, you are guaranteed a FAPE, free and appropriate public education, which I call FAPE, because that's how my computer pronounced. And that is federal law. So when you in secondary school, there are a card if someone goes on to college, but it's not the same standard. Number two, if you don't go on to college, you've got nothing behind you because federal standards you in the education system now don't apply because you're technically able to work. And there is a standard for disability very different from so children are kind of pitted, if you will, or placed up against a child of their age and experience. Learn the thing, act in ways that are comparable to children of their age and experience in everyday educational situation. And then when you get to be an adult, standard is totally different. You're not put in that standard. You're evaluated on whether or not you can work. And most people are just assumed to be able to hold a job. That is what the assumption is. Until you prove it wrong, that's what it is. And so in order to be determined disabled, It's a completely different standard employment, you know, to be able to make a living, a condition that's going to last for, you have to prove it. There are all other things that go into that determination. But you have to actually ask to be determined disabled. It's not something that you're just granted automatically. Like I said, you know, you have to be able to work. So first you have to ask for it. You have to ask benefits. And while you're asking, long time for them to get to you. So Linda, as you said, your parent, primary caregiver, even though you're an adult. And for many folks who are disabled, it can be a little disheartening because intellectually, you know, they graduated from high school. Maybe they went to college. I don't know. But there's something physically going on that's preventing them from working to meet. And so they feel in this sort of limbo place while they're waiting, you know, maybe get their health and monetary benefits proved. And then for others, they, you know, some with some abilities or some neurodivergent, like autism, they're not very high physically and they can't hold a job, but yet they're still waiting to get those adult benefits because they have to be evaluated for them and their parents are still caring for them. And so this puts parents in an awkward position because especially in many of the cases where there are severe physical problems or intellectual issues going on, parents know that they're going to be caregivers for, like, I don't know, the life. And this gets real strange when that child is an adult because all of a sudden they have these adult rights and they have these adult, there are assumptions about things that they can do as adults, marrying, understanding and signing their own contract, voting, buying houses, you know, anything that an adult do automatically to be able to do. So the parent is in a position where legally they don't have the same authority over their adult child as they did over their child. And especially in situations where there's an intellectual disability and that adult child is going to remain mentally a child, parents have a very hard time getting their heads around that. Well, my child can't do these adult things. Why is it assumed that she can? And so that's one issue that we tackle, the issue of guardianship, is what we call it in the U.S., the guardianship of the person, adult child rights, so to speak, and making sure that the parents are the best people to preserve those rights and help them assert them. And then also, the parent needs to start having this uncomfortable conversation with themselves and hopefully with an expert about who is going to, when I'm not here, I'm the guardian now. Let's pretend they've been appointed by the court, that they've been named a guardian. But who's going to do it when I'm not able? And I have found that, especially while talking to clients who are parents, and they're so busy planning for their child and or adult child, making sure that that person has what they need to have a fulfilling and happy life within the social limitations that they have, and also they really don't have the bandwidth to think about that child's future and the ramifications of what will happen when not here for them, and when that child receives an inheritance from those parents, which opens up a completely arm. And so one of the things that is very near and dear to my heart is helping people create plans that support them in determining who will be their child's guardian and decisions about how that inherits, so that when something does happen to the parent and the parent's no longer available to care for that child, someone that knows and loves the child as much as the parent does will be able to care for them and will also have access to funds to use for that child's benefit, and using them in such a way that the adult child's government benefits are not disrupted.
Yeah, we previously just, yes, they age out, so it's like the day they turn 18, the child goes away, and in Canada, the federal Canada Pension Plan disability benefit has a requirement to have worked to the Canada Pension Plan job, then you're not eligible for the federal, what we call CPPD, which is the Canada Pension Plan disability, paid into the Canada Pension Plan. So that leaves disabilities that age out into the system at 18, responsible or seeing them in the province of Ontario anyway, for getting lined up and for what we call the Ontario Disability Support Program. Mm-hmm. And ODSP, as it's called, has some real guidelines in terms of assets you can own, whether or not you come, and you know, kind of thing that people get from ODSP is not amount of money live on your own and buy your own groceries and, you know, do that type of stuff. So that really leaves those children, while they might get ODSP benefits, the now adult disabled person will get ODSP benefits. The real burden is still on the parent to provide for the terms of, you know, housing and medical care and whatever else is required, and to do all of whether it's the planning and the applications and, you know, waiting for them to do stuff. And I had a client probably a year ago that was struggled the fact that her husband also disabled, had a child with a disability that was into the system, and in all of her time basically trying to navigate the fact that both her husband or her child who had a disability required home care. She needed support in order to provide personal care for both her husband and her disabled child that had now aged into being an adult. As you said, the bandwidth parent, I mean, and this is someone trying to maintain time employment, because she now is not just a caregiver for primary caregiver for her child, and the level of support that she's getting was not adequate for her to be able to manage. And as she said to me, what's going to happen to both of them if something happens to me? This is where people don't realize the true impact. As you said, certainly an adult with an intellectual disability or a child not, you know, being medically fragile and has then, you know, adult the supports and services that they had when they were a child. As I said, stop literally on their 18th birthday. But buyers, and now it's onus is on the parent adult.
And it's hard for the parent sometimes to understand that the supports and services that were there in school are not there. You know, they're not the same as an adult, because it'd be, I guess, a responsible member of society and support themselves in a lot of ways. And some people, and I actually talk to some parents, and they're like, come to me, and they have a misconception about what I actually do, which is really interesting. They say, well, help me get my child and plan for their death, because they assume that their child is going to die first. And it's really odd. I've had this happen several times, and the child may not even be medically fragile. I'm going to be here for my child forever, for their whole life. And, you know, they've only got me on. And while at the moment that may be true, I actually have to flip the conversation and say, actually, I'm here to help you provide for yourself. And that is support yourself so that when you're no longer here, you can still support your child, you know, your legacy. And that is a really novel concept for many parents, to that indeed their lives are important too. What they have worked for, you know, is important as well, to make sure to have things structured in such a way that their child can be maintained apart from them.
Yes, and certainly, I know personally, I have a niece that grew up as a medically fragile child. She's now 29, so for the last 11 years, her ability status, she turned 18, but all of the that her parents had to seek out for her the day. They're faced with when they're here to look after, and as you said, there's, and in their case, they assume that the way before. So when they're here to look after her, you're right. Who is going to be responsible, and is that going to be able to case of my niece? Are they going to be able to look after them, and they're going to have to go into a group home or some other form of. And there are a lot of people. I have neighbors that have a daughter now well into her 50s. She lives home because they got to be on an age. Their parents were not physically to care for her because they themselves dealing with the with all of the challenges that go with just the fact that now they're in their 80s. So much as they're still alive, that does, that they have the capacity to be time cared. So many different scenarios. What you do is a part of that done in advance so that happened. But you've got those plans in place so that what's going to happen.
And that you said, well, which is when you're receiving benefits, as a there are limits on what you can own, how much you can work. And Ontario, in the United States, we have the same kinds of limits. And they're very strict, actually. And they not only affect how much money you can have, but they also affect whether or not you can receive health benefits, those same limits. And first became really interested and aware of this particular problem when I was a college student, and I actually was receiving disability benefits as a student going to college. The theory, I'm not gainfully employed yet, but my college will allow me to be. So while I'm not able to still get the benefit, so I was getting the benefit, but I was working, and I was, I wouldn't say college student, but I didn't know the rules. Who knows these rules? People who, and so I would work, and I would work 2 months, and I would have to pay back into the system the amount of money that I overworked. It was almost, so I never felt like, you know, my working made any kind of a difference. And so, like, I don't understand it. If it impacts me, how much more would it impact someone who would never be able to work? Because that's what that's not able to work. And then what would happen if someone inherited a bunch of money, who had a family death, and that got me started thinking about it, even in college. And I didn't inherit anything, but, you know, what would have happened? And then I started working at a nonprofit law firm. I was not doing the work I am now, but I was working with a lot of disabled and the nonprofit exists to serve people in poverty, which, as you alluded to before, most people who've got disabilities are also in poverty because they're not able to work and the government benefit does not provide a living, enough money to. And so the problem came when either when money. And so there were these asset limits. They didn't know about them. And so they received money from relatives or family or something, inheritances. You tuck them away and take enough of the money. So like the Security Administration or Medicaid or Medicare, which are the health in my state, would get wind of the inheritance. Eventually they would be reported because they didn't know they had, but eventually get found out. And they'd say, okay, $150,000 overpayment, and I have to pay it back. And so that's a number I just threw out there, let's just say. And so they would get, and they still do, but I would see these letters in the mail. We understand you can't pay back your, this is essentially what it says. We understand you can't pay back your money. So, well, I don't know. We're deducting $100 worth of benefits from you from now until you pay it back. And they give this table of payments, deductions. And, you know, it'll, $250,000 would last a whole lifetime. And we would get these calls and they would say, this because this is ridiculous. I now have less money than I had before because I used up my inheritance. I didn't know. My answer is, well, we'll have to see about that, but there are rules. You're supposed to report it, you know, whatever the rules are in the particular situation. And that really, that would always make me so sad because these are not things that most people know. You know, it's not something that's regularly communicated to you and say, well, how am I supposed to know? So I really wanted to make it my mission, or at least a substantial portion of people understand what will happen when their loved ones, disabled children, get an inheritance from them. And this is what the planning is actually what needs to be addressed before estate planning that needs to be addressed, how to protect inheritance so that it won't be counted against them. And it will only be, it will hands completely. They will never touch it. And the parent says, well, that's cruel, depriving them of it. And I answer, well, no, because what we're doing is finding that person, you know, that person who's going to care for them. We're finding a person who could manage that for them and spend it on things approved of so that it does, so that their memory of you is not of pain, but is rather that you get something beautiful. You improved their lives in some way. You left behind something that they will always think of and remember you, which is basically care for them.
Yeah.
And I don't want that taken away from them by government rules that no one knows about.
Exactly. And it's almost like you're, they don't, the benefit from the government forces you to live in poverty. And then if, should you get an inheritance, the requirement is almost that you will, until it's all gone, and then you can come back to us, but requirement that you must live in this impoverished state, mm-hmm. In order to apply for benefits is really what is, really what, and we are very much the same in Canada. Before you can even qualify for benefits, you can't have any more than $1,000 in assets, which means you can't own a home, and most, well, you can't own a car. You can't have savings in order to qualify for the benefit alone. You have to have used up all of your savings or your money to qualify, which in my mind, it's penal but the other thing that people don't understand, certainly me as somebody with a physical disability, is that it's expensive to be.
Yes, it is.
It's, you know, I'm sitting in a wheelchair that costs more than a car. I am new to me, but a used wheelchair van, which is required to transport. I still drive, but a lot of people pay a wheelchair van in order to transport me. And most of that vehicle of a regular vehicle, not to mention just the if you do require any kind of any kind of mobility aid, anything that you require in your home in terms of an accessibility modification thing that's related to to someone with a disability. It's expensive.
And the beauty of what you said, Linda, is at least here in, yes, it is expensive to be disabled. The things that you need as a disabled individual, using that inheritance that you got, disabled person, not you, but the person who's disabled, just for that person, and then they can end up owning their own home. They wouldn't have the title necessarily, but their trust would own their own wheelchair van through their trust, which is necessary so that they have their hands on the, but those things are government approved ways to spend that money. And so the beauty of entrusting your inheritance to this arrangement is so that the trustee can make that it's spent on government-approved items, and most of those are very much things that can improve anyone, adult disabled, prosper, in control of their own life.
Yeah, and I think that persons with disabilities have the ability to be active and engaged members of their community to the extent that they to be. And that everyone's life, regardless of your disability, has value. We're going to wrap here. I just any last work that you do, and I guess for me it would be, because I always say that people don't know what they don't care, which is why I was so glad to have you in an area where people don't understand the ins and outs of.
I would have, you know, you've been able to make your own will since maybe the 600s AD, but we haven't been really working with these kinds of trust arrangements for more than 40, 45 years, which is in legal terms, really a new type of thing. And so as learn and grow and they develop and government benefits change, then, and I think it's really important for parents who do have disabled children to always read their letters from Social Security or in Canada from whatever benefits letters you get, always read them. And if you don't understand it, get another person to read it. And between the two of you, because I can't tell, I have run into who say, well, I just never read those letters. I just assume all they talk about is how much the benefit will increase this year. But really, they said other things. You didn't know about it. And some kind of appeal deadline passed or something. And you needed to know. So I'll just leave people with that. They're really important.
Always great. Always great advice. Make sure you read anything you get from the government, because you want to make sure you're well informed. Well, thank you again, Erin, for joining us, and for those of you who are joining us and listening. If you have any questions or you want to reach out to Erin, Erin's contact information will be in the show notes. And thank you for listening to the Accessibility Solutions Time. Cheers.
Thank you for joining us on the Accessibility Solutions podcast hosted by Linda Hunt. We hope these discussions have inspired you and provided valuable insights into the world of accessibility and inclusion. If you're ready to take the next steps in creating an accessible and inclusive environment, we invite you to book a personalized accessibility solutions consultation with Linda. As an experienced accessibility consultant, Linda will work closely with you to develop innovative solutions tailored to your unique needs and challenges. Together, you'll navigate the complexities of accessibility regulations, explore inclusive design principles, and implement practical strategies to ensure equal access for all. Don't miss this opportunity to make a real difference. Visit our website at solutionsforaccessibility.com. And that's the number 4. So solutionsforaccessibility.com. Schedule your consultation today. Let's transform your space into an inclusive and welcoming environment for everyone. Thanks again for listening to the Accessibility Solutions podcast. Stay tuned for more empowering episodes as we continue our journey towards a more accessible world.